Hey, everybody, welcome to the Green Room of Disrupt TV. We've got our two amazing guests. We're going to introduce them in reverse order, ask them where they're coming in from, and if they felt it or not. You'll know what that means in a few days later. So, Eric, where are you coming in from? What are we talking about today?
I'm here from the San Francisco Bay Area. We're talking about my new book, The AI Playbook, which Mastering the Rare Art of Machine Learning Deployment. Unfortunately, this art is still rare. Most enterprise machine learning projects, with all their potential, actually fail to achieve deployment. And we're going to talk about the enterprise practice so that we can get the track record much better in terms of deployment success.
Rarer than an earthquake in New Jersey. Paul, where are you coming in from? What are we talking about today?
Speaking of that, I'm coming in from New Jersey, where the, as AC/DC would say, the earth was shaken not too long ago. And we're looking forward to having another session with you guys talking about all things AI. It'll be great to hear what Eric's talking about on deployment, because that is such a key thing. Is, you know, how do you really get this stuff in and working? And we'll talk a little bit about some of the patterns, what we're seeing, and what we've been investing in.
And of course, human by design. We cannot live without that. And so we'll get there as well. All right. Well, hey, back to you, Elle, for the count, and then we'll start the show.
All right.
3, 2, 1. Welcome. Thank you for joining us on Disrupt TV. My name is Vala Afshar. I'm the Chief Digital Evangelist at Salesforce and your co-host for the next hour. We welcome you to follow us on X at Disrupt TV Show. It's my pleasure to introduce my co-host, Ray Wong. He's the CEO, founder of Constellation Research. He's the best-selling author of Everybody Wants to Rule the World. I see Ray on TV just about every day. CNBC, Fox Business, Yahoo Finance, Bloomberg. In my humble opinion, he's one of the top futurists to follow on X at RWANG0. Welcome, Ray Wong, Disrupt TV.
Hey, thanks a lot. I'm here with amazing co-host Vala Afshar, the Chief Digital Evangelist for Salesforce. He's also the author of multiple books, including Boundless, A New Mindset for an Unlimited Business Success, and a number one seller on Amazon. But executives around the world, they pay attention to every one of his insightful and inspirational tweets. But when he's not keynoting, speaking, leading events, sharing ideas at Salesforce, you can find him on TV outlets like Bloomberg and writing his thoughts and putting them down at ZDNet. But it's not about us. It's about our amazing guests. And every week we bring on someone great, new, and sometimes we bring back repeat guests. Who do we have to kick it off today?
Ray, we have a first ballot Hall of Fame Disrupt TV inductee, one of our favorite guests of all time. Paul Daugherty, Group Chief Executive, Technology and Chief Technology Officer at Accenture, and a member of the Accenture's Global Management Committee. Paul leads Accenture's innovation strategy and organization. Paul also directs Accenture's global research and development into emerging technology areas, including what we're going to talk about, AI, generative AI, quantum computing, and space technologies. Paul leads Accenture's annual Technology Vision Report, one of my favorite reports. And he hosts annual innovation forum events and leads Accenture Ventures, which he founded. Most recently, Paul helped lay the groundwork for Accenture's, wait, listen to this, $3 billion investment in its data and AI practice to help clients rapidly and responsibly advance the use of AI, including generative AI. Last year, Paul received the prestigious St. Patrick's Day Science Medal for Industry Forum Science Foundation, Ireland, as well as nomination to Thinkers 50. A ranking of the world's most influential management leaders. He's a co-author of two highly acclaimed books, Human Plus Machine and Radically Human. You can follow Paul on X at Paul Daugh, D-A-U-G-H. Welcome back, Paul, to Disrupt TV.
Oh, hey, Paul. So I think Paul's a little frozen at the moment. Let's hope he comes back when he comes in. But Paul has been doing a ton of work on Gen AI. He's been doing a ton of work on the tech vision, and we're going to be able to talk to him on all those counts. Hopefully he can refresh, bring him back in and bring him there. So, one of the things that we've been seeing as well is it's the age of AI. And then when I was at Davos this year, one of the things that I saw at Accenture doing really well was the ability to bring workshops. And Paul, as you know, like those workshops you were performing at Davos were really great. I mean, you're really talking about where it is. And Gen AI has been really on everybody's minds, and it's kind of their attention. You guys have been putting folks to this. What's going on, right? This is more than a fad. This is the age of AI. And what are people talking to you about?
Yeah, the you mentioned Davos, and that was maybe kind of emblematic of how we think about generative AI. And we really do believe that generative AI is a massive innovation and a big step forward in terms of how we all need to conduct business. I would argue it's the biggest innovation that will impact business across the whole 70 years since the invention of the silicon-based transistor that will impact, it'll have the most impact of business of anything we've seen in that period, which is saying a lot, but I believe that's true. And it's because the technology itself is adapting more of a human-like capability, which unleashes new levels of human potential. That's kind of at the heart of a lot of the work that I've been doing and that we've been doing at Accenture. And that's why we took a different approach in Davos this year, as I think we talked about when we bumped into each other over there. And rather than the typical large Davos panels and such, we actually got small groups of CEOs, 4, 5, 6 in a room, and had learning workshops to immerse leaders firsthand in what the technology is, what it can do, how it can impact their business. So we really believe it is having such a profound impact that the learning needs to start with the leaders, and the leaders need to lead by learning and then take that learning to their organizations so that they can shape the roadmaps accordingly.
It was so interesting because I talked to a CEO that walked out of one of your sessions, and he said, I've never really gotten the feel of what it was until I did the hands-on work with you guys. Right. And he said, like, now I can actually understand and explain that to everybody else. And it was so powerful. And then I talked to another CEO, and she basically said, yeah, this was the most amazing session I had at Davos. I didn't know we could do this at Davos.
Yeah, it was fun. It was a different approach. And it's kind of, it's it reflects our hands-on approach to learning.
So I want to ground the folks watching who may not be familiar with your work. Accenture's generative AI revenue surpassed all venture-backed startups combined. Accenture recorded $1.1 billion from generative AI projects just in the first half of the fiscal year. Last quarter, $600 million plus on Gen AI projects. So I'm going to make this statement, and Ray, correct me if I'm wrong. I believe Accenture is deploying, optimizing, and transforming businesses using AI more than any other company on earth.
And wow, they should be getting the valuation.
If you agree with this premise, which I agree, that and since you're the leader of technology, vision, strategy, and practice at Accenture, this makes you, Paul, the leader of the largest AI business transformation programs on earth. So that's a pretty big responsibility. I want to better understand how you prepare yourself when you're leading the world in implementation of AI transformation in business. And here's the premise that I'm trying to better understand. You wrote this in 2018. Yep. And in this, you had 1,500 case studies. So it probably took you 2-3 years of research. It took me 5 years of research to write my book. So this means 10 years ago, you wrote a book that says Reimagining Work in the Age of AI. That's a journey you started 10 years ago. And then you followed up with another book before, the world opened its eyes to open AI. This was April of 2022, 2 years ago. And again, you not warned us, but you gently reminded us, Listen, if you're ignoring AI, you're ignoring electricity for the 21st century. So my question to you is, what do you do? Is there pressure for you to always be 10 years ahead of trends? and how do you educate and inspire and stay so far ahead of the rest of us when it comes to these transformative technologies?
Well, it's you know, part of it's that we have an amazing organization at Accenture. So we're big, 730,000 people around the world. We serve thousands of clients who are doing, where we do all sorts of interesting work, and we work with every one of the large and small ecosystem partners out there. So we kind of have a vantage point both of everything that's happening in technology, because we're the leading partner with most of the large and small technology companies, and we see through our clients the way that's being applied all over the place. And then we have our R&D organization, where we spend $1 billion a year on research and development, which is a lot for a company like us. And so you put all those things together, combined with the academic partnerships and smart people like you guys that we talk to and everything else, and that's what gives us the window into the future. It's very intentional. We have an innovation architecture and approach we use to look ahead, and it's something that we do, and that's why we do things like when we see the opportunity coming. That's why we do things like we did last year, which you mentioned earlier, Bala, where we announced the $3 billion. Investment in data and AI over 3 years, and we're kind of at or ahead of progress on spending that money in very good ways. And that's a big bet. Again, that's a big investment for a company like us in the professional services industry, and it's because we believe this is game changing for companies, and that we need to do certain things to help them transform as fast as they need to do. And as Eric will talk about later, figure out how do you deliver the value from this stuff as well. And so for us, that investment goes to things. It goes to things like the work we do for clients. We're building a workbench called the AI Navigator to help clients deploy AI and generative AI more rapidly. It's going into how we deliver our own services, because generative AI impacts Accenture as much as any company out there. We have 200,000 plus software engineers. We're at scale training them on using Copilot and other type of capability, Code Whisperer, all the different tools that are out there to drive the services we deliver more effectively. And we're applying it ourselves. We have a lot of great generative AI experiments, as well as scaled implementations that we've invested in internally. Something called Amethyst that hundreds of thousands of our people use to get access in generative AI model to get access to information more quickly. That's having real impact and a lot more. And then the other part of the investment that may be interesting is we're taking positions through Accenture Ventures in exciting startups like Writer, which is one that we're now using internally in our marketing organization, like Ocean Genomics, just generative AI and life sciences and molecular structures and such, like Sanctuary.ai, which is kind of generative AI and other technologies in humanoid form factor robotics. And we're acquiring companies like Futura, which is industrial AI automation, Albert, which is a leader in AI in Japan, and other companies. That's what we're doing with the money. And then underneath that, training our people. So we promised when we did the $3 billion investment, we're going to take our 40,000 AI professionals and double it to 80,000. And we're at, say we're at 53,000 now, only about 6 months into it. We said we'd do that over 3 years. We'll get there a lot faster than that. And that's the way we do that is kind of interesting too. We have at scale training, learning capabilities we can talk about a little bit later, including a business we launched called LearnVantage, which leverages our own internal training to help our clients. And we also form partnerships like what we've done with Stanford. We have a foundation model scholar program with Stanford, where we certify foundation model deep specialized engineers jointly across Accenture and Stanford, leveraging their faculty, which is amazing, and our experts. So a lot of different things like that. That's how we're putting the money to work. And as a result, we're doing roughly 1,000 generative AI projects for clients right now, about 30% of them going from experimentation to scale stages and able to see the real impact.
And my company certainly benefits from all of what you just said. You certainly, Accenture is
great
turbocharging our success and our partnership. So thank you for helping us stretch higher with the capabilities that you have. Go ahead, Ray.
Yeah, no, I was thinking Going back to your book, Human Machine, right? A lot of this work that we're doing today is the collaboration and working together between, you know, machines, humans, and the outcomes there. And you're pretty favorable on the view on how we were going to collaborate and move forward. We've seen the machine scale level of change that's going on here with humans in that process. Has that changed the way you look at this collaboration? And do you think about things differently as to, you know, some people look at the world like, you know, where we're going to automate, we're going to apply AI. But then we're also seeing another view where it's when and where do we insert a human in the process? How does that all come together for you?
No, I'm glad you asked that, because we're in the midst of a lot of research around that right now. And there's going to be a new edition of this one coming out in a few months. Harvard asked us to...
Breaking news.
HBR Press asked us to reissue the book. So we've done a lot of updates. We've done some new research, and that'll be coming out. It'll look the same, but it'll be a lot of new content research in it. And as we dug back through it, what we saw was that the premise we had in human plus machine really held up well. And we see tremendous evidence that what we call the missing middle, which is the new jobs, it's missing because people don't talk about them as much and focus on it as much. And it's the middle, you know, between machines and humans. That missing middle is where we see a lot of the human potential, a lot of the productivity, a lot of the creativity, a lot of the growth opportunities for people and for companies coming. And we have a ton of new evidence, we're putting in the book from when we first published it 6 years ago. And generative AI is then adding to that by expanding the capability you have in that middle. And yes, there are jobs that are automated away by AI, by generative AI, and by the way, by the PC and by the telegraph. And it's just the way technology works. The real interesting thing is, how do you change the jobs and how do you re-equip people with the ability to do, you know, to have superpowers to do new and different jobs and do jobs better? And that's no different than prior technologies. That's what we see in this, albeit early stage of generative AI. And we give a lot of examples in there. For example, work we're already doing in our Accenture Song business to allow creative professionals to create brand campaigns and outputs much more effectively and with more creativity than they can do before. So we think the premise really stands up. That's the case we're going to make strongly in the book. It's controversial now. It was very controversial when we wrote Human Plus Machine. We got a lot of pushback, but slowly a lot of the tide changed. And then with generative AI, it flipped right back to everybody getting very negative on the role of humans in this new world. And again, we believe this holds up. And unless you believe we're at the end of the need for work and the end of the need for any new services that we as people will want to consume, but we think there's a bright future ahead still.
I imagine it takes a lot of courage and conviction and tremendous spirited debates when you produce your annual Tech Vision report, where 10 years ago, you were telling executives and business leaders, listen, digital transformation is going to be a top of mind topic. This is 10 years ago. And now this year's Technology Vision report, annual report entitled Human by Design, some of the forecasts I wanted to share with our audience, these are predictions in the section, the chapter called A Match Made in AI. By 2025, leading airline will announce that customers are just as satisfied with chatbot agents as human agents. By 2028, major corporations will have proprietary chatbots to assist with knowledge management, research, and task completion. By 2029, AI advisors will receive more search traffic than traditional search engines. By 2026, right around the corner, 3/4 of knowledge workers will use Copilot every single day. Now, every year, you also revisit prior year's predictions. And I got to tell you, it's an incredibly accurate, precise predictions and major categories that are not boardroom discussions, and you've been authoring this for 10 years. Tell us about the process. Tell us about some important takeaways that folks who may not be familiar with the report should really look into as they read the 2024 Technology Vision Report.
Yeah, I think the most important, you talked about one chapter, and the next chapter is the one that's most interesting to me, which is talking about autonomous agents and the future that they hold. And it's interesting, just today, I was on with founder CEOs of two different startups that are doing amazing things to go beyond Copilot. So it's Copilot type capabilities that could also operate autonomously and do amazing things on behalf of us as consumers, as employees, et cetera. And I think the trends, if anything, the dates we gave around autonomous agent type of capability, I think we were too conservative. I think it's going to likely come faster. Similarly, the chapter after that then is called The Space We Need, which is talking about spatial computing. And what I, you know, the joke I used to explain that one is the metaverse is dead, long live the metaverse. And we're taking a position in the vision, which I believe that while we all may have learned to hate the word metaverse and discard it, the trends around the fact that we will have a three-dimensional spatial digital world to interact with, I think is undeniable and is happening with, you know, with Apple's announcements, Sony's announcements, and everything that's happening. We just have to work our way through the technology. And so we're talking in there about how it's going to happen and how it is happening in the industrial world first, which is why we don't see it maybe in the media as much, and then starting to bleed into the consumer world. And then finally, we talk about quantum a little bit in there too, which is starting to get interesting based on some of the things that are happening in PQC, you know, post quantum cryptography, and the need to take action in those areas.
That's yeah, Paul, how many people contribute to the report roughly? Is that something you can reveal?
We have a team we have a core team of say dozen-ish people. Yeah. We work at it year round. It's
of course you have to.
We're always kind of working at it. We have an advisory board of people we consider to be smart people and challenge us on it from both ends of the spectrum. You want the the conservative and you want the science fiction visionaries. So we have an advisory board of folks that help us year in, year out. And we collect a lot of ideas and crowdsource a lot of it from our people and our clients as well. So we have a kind of a broad canvas to look at to do it.
I appreciate what you do because every year it's my most popular ZDNet article. So thank you. I look forward to the report every year anxiously.
Hey, related to that, I mean, we've been talking about this need for creating the skills for the future, right? And some of the skills are really around AI and where that's going. And you've been talking about the importance of that training and reskilling that needs to happen. And really, you announced the launch of this training platform called LearnVantage. And then I think yesterday, you guys also announced this big consortium to really make commitments to training a good number of people in terms of skilling, along with a whole bunch of tech companies. Tell us a little more about that and why that's so important as we make that transition to AI.
Yeah. So we announced LearnVantage about a month ago. Something we've been, something we've been working on for quite a while. Because we believe one of our core competencies, one of our differentiators, is our learning engine. We have 730,000 people around the world, and we have to spin their skills and capabilities continuously, so that they're the most relevant resource, you know, for the clients that we work with. And we've been doing that for years, you know, in kind of running and tuning and refining and enhancing that engine. A lot of AI in there to identify things like skills adjacency and learning proficiency and how to, you know, if you know this, then you can learn this this other thing quickly. So we've been doing that for a while. We've been toying with the idea of we should do this for our clients. And it just turned out over the last few years, more and more clients said, hey, we want to learn to do what you do. We started having CEOs come to us and say, can you do this for us? And so we've been doing it for clients for a while. And then we finally said, let's just name it and turn it into a business. And that's LearnVantage.
LearnVantage
is the name of that business. We had a lot of our own platforms, but we needed a new platform to take certain of those capabilities to market. So we announced the acquisition of Udacity, which we're super excited about, bringing that together with the capabilities we had and with the ecosystem we work with, Coursera and others that are very important to what we do. And that's forming the core of this new business. And that was in addition to all those other billion-dollar numbers I was tossing about earlier, that's another $1 billion that we're investing in this business to get it launched and out to the market.
Wow, that's pretty powerful. So,
you know, a commitment to taking 40,000 to 80,000 data and AI practitioners by fiscal 26, and you're at 53,000. So clearly, you're going to exceed, the targets you have. And you've been also, in addition to talking about the importance of AI in business, you've been leading discussions in terms of ethical and responsible use of AI.
Yeah.
As you scale, Paul, to like just 80,000 in your own company and all of these, you know, Fortune 100 companies that are leaning into Accenture to not only learn about this new technology and capability, but do it in an ethical, responsible way. Can you talk about how much effort in training and enablement goes into just understanding how to properly use the technology to advance society in a good way?
It's something we really focus on. Our CEO, Julie Sweet, is like super committed to responsible use of technology. So it starts at the top with Julie and the board in kind of what we do. So it's not just me. It's kind of in, sure. It's in our core purpose of what we think about it. Our mission statement is to deliver on the promise of technology and human ingenuity. And to do that, it needs to be done in a responsible way and with trust. That's kind of the grounding of it. But there was a chapter in Human Plus Machine 6 years ago where we wrote about responsible AI and what we thought needed to be done. And since then, we've been focused on doing it and taking that and doing it. So we believe that that's what's missing. There's a responsible AI gap that we're trying to educate companies on and help clients address. 95% of companies will say that they believe it's responsible AI is important. They believe they need to be responsible. And about that number can list a set of principles, bias and accuracy and human, focusing on the human needs and such. But only 2% of companies have systemic policies and processes and tools in place to ensure it. So 95-2, that's the gap. A lot of good talk, not a lot of action around it. We've been really focused on putting the action in place for about 3 years now. So we have a responsible AI program. It's a formal compliance program, just like anti-corruption and the other compliance programs. We report on it quarterly to our board of directors on responsible AI and our progress. And we can identify every single use of AI in our company. We can tell you the risk level of every single instance of AI that we're doing for ourselves and our clients. And we can tell you how we're mitigating for the risks that are inherent in the way that that kind of AI can be used. If you can't do those three things, you can't say you're doing responsible AI if you can only talk about the principles. So that's what I always ask companies. Can you answer those three questions? If you can't, Wow. You've got a gap and you got to work, do the hard work, which is the policies, the compliance programs, it's the tools, and it's the culture and trainings that everybody understands it. Every one of our employees has to take training around responsible AI. It's part of the TQ that we make required.
I know I'm asking for the special sauce, but I'm really intrigued. How does a 750,000 company not only maintain a sense of urgency to always be a leading actor in terms of understanding and inspiring and educating society about emerging tech? What is it about the Accenture culture that you can move like a startup? Like
change is like we just embrace change. It's always been part of our DNA. Hmm. I've been around in the company a long time, as you know, before it even had its current name of Accenture, and we've always embraced change through every era of Accenture, and I think that's part of it. That change is good, and it's benefited us because in the technology business, you've got to embrace change. Yeah. If you're afraid, I remember when SaaS came about and Salesforce was new, we had people coming to us, clients, investors, and others saying, you guys shouldn't be doing SaaS. That's bad for your business. It's going to hurt your on-premise business. We're like, that's nuts. SaaS is great technology. It's going to deliver a great benefit for our clients. We're going to be best and first at it, and that's going to grow our business. And so that mantra of always being first to, the first mover and first to seize any technology, regardless of what you think the immediate implication might be in our current business, and build the new business around it. That's just how we think. And that's same with generative AI. Generative AI, yeah, it's going to change a lot of what we do. We had probably approaching 100,000 people less than a decade ago that would have done testing, hands-on keyboard testing. Lots of people. We have near zero today. Because not generative, but traditional AI, allow you to test and automate in different ways. Those people who are doing testing, they might be doing test design or they might be doing other tasks. It's not like they're not doing anything, but you don't need them doing that skill anymore. That's an example of this rotation that you need to, and that's why the learning and other things become important. So we're just, it's part of how we think about the future.
That's amazing.
So Paul, when you look at the future, do we is it still Gen AI, or are we going to see other types of AI come back to vogue as we get away from solving probabilistic company problems and going back to deterministic? So
great question. I really believe, I don't know if there's a lot of different people about Rodney Brooks and Gary Marcus and all sorts of people who are
talking
about this stuff and different angles on stuff. I really believe that generative AI is an amazing breakthrough, and founded in kind of deep learning and everything else. I really believe that, like some out there are saying, that the real bigger breakthroughs are going to come when you bring back symbolic AI in certain ways, melded with generative AI. Yep. And then when you look at other new advances coming in generative AI, like large action models, it can blend some of those capabilities in. I think that's, it's going to take us years, I think, to get all that right, how that comes together. But I think that's when it gets really interesting, is the combinatorial effect of some of those advances.
That will be the next breakthrough.
Paul, remind us when the next edition is going to be available. Do you have a sense?
I think it's end of the summer. End of the summer.
Wow. Oh, great, great. So look forward to it. Please consider coming back.
On my desk right now from the editing. So yeah, still
fine. We'll hear with Paul Doherty, Chief Technology and Innovation Officer at Accenture. You can follow him at X at Paul Doe, D-A-U-G-H. Thank you so much for being on here. And hope everything's okay and no more aftershocks.
No, yeah. Well, thanks. And thanks for the time. Always so fun to talk to you guys. And I can't wait to hear what Eric has to say. So I'll be staying up.
All right, we'll see you back in the green room.
You're terrific. Thank you. Am I wrong, Ray, when I say he's the leader of the largest company on earth helping businesses transform and adopt AI? I mean, just the numbers speak for
itself. You're completely right. And I believe that they should tell their investor relations team that, because they'll get a pop on their multiple. I mean, look at how much they're going on there. They've got more AI revenue than everyone else. Like, someone should be hammering that puppy.
So, we're so fortunate because we get to learn from the best and brightest in various fields and industries and technologies, is no exception with our next guest. Eric Siegel is author of the AI Playbook, Mastering the Rare Art of Machine Learning Deployment. Eric is a leading consultant and former Columbia University professor who helps companies deploy machine learning. Eric is the founder of the long-running Machine Learning Week conference series, the instructor of the acclaimed online course, Machine Learning Leadership and Practice End-to-End Mastery, and executive editor of the Machine Learning Times. He's obviously a global keynote speaker on the topic. Eric wrote the best-selling book, Predictive Analytics, The Power to Predict Who Will Click, Buy, Lie, or Die, which has been used in courses at hundreds of universities. At Columbia, Eric won the Distinguished Faculty Award when teaching the graduate computer science courses in ML and AI. You can follow Eric on X, Twitter, at Predict Analytic, A-N-A-L-Y-T-I-C. Welcome, Eric, to Disrupt TV.
Thanks, Ray and Vala. Great to be on the show.
Thank you.
Hey, we're so glad to have you here. And, you know, we've been talking a lot about, what it is, how it's going to work. Most people are trying to figure out how to do it now. And your book is perfectly timed to talk about that. You titled your book, The AI Playbook, and it focuses a lot on ML. What inspired the title?
Well, listen, the established practice of what people have been calling AI for decades is really predictive AI. Generative AI is sort of the new flavor. They're really quite different things. But if you want to improve your large-scale operations, all your existing processes, such as for targeting, marketing, fraud, which wheel of a train to inspect is potentially failing, which satellite to inspect is potentially running out of a battery, credit risk management, insurance pricing, that's where you have predictive applications. This is technology machine learning that learns from data to make predictions that as to whether each individual will click, buy, lie, or die, commit an act of fraud, turn out to be a bad credit risk, in order to improve operations. Business is a numbers game, and all large-scale operations consists of many micro decisions. We don't have a magic crystal ball, but predicting better than guessing is generally more than sufficient to improve the bottom line in these large-scale operations. So today, and for the last year and a half, when people say AI, they're mostly referring to generative AI, which also uses under the hood the same core technology, learning from data to predict. In that case, you're predicting which of the next word or on that level of detail token be when I'm writing a paragraph or a piece of code. How should I change or the computer change this pixel while rendering this image? And the reason it's called generative is because it generates new content items, right? So it's a very different way of applying the technology. And I'm here today to tell you some good news and some bad news. Good news is that there's hype, okay? I think the generative AI thing is overhyped at least by a factor of 10. If it's worth 10% of the hype, that's still a lot. The good news is that the antidote to hype is to focus on concrete value propositions. How are you going to deploy? What are the operations of your organization that are going to improve with this technology, with the predictions that are output by a predictive model that was learned from historical cases? Data is a recording of history. It's the experience of an organization from which it's possible to learn these outcomes and behaviors. And being able to predict those and put odds on them is the holy grail for improving most any and all of your large-scale operations. So right now, all the excitement about this generative, which is so seemingly human-like and in a very amazing way, a way I never thought I'd see in this lifetime, still is falling for a problem where it's solutionism. So let me give a quote from University of Toronto management professor Minia Moldovanu.
Yep.
She said, AI strategies fail because AI is a means, not an end. Do you have an AI strategy? Makes as much sense as asking, do you have an Excel strategy? It's about planning for the deployment. How are you going to be changing and improving operations? And as seemingly human-like as it is, ironically, that actually makes generative AI less potentially autonomous than these predictive use cases where they're not trying to do something humans did. They're just trying to tip the odds in these large-scale numbers games that enterprises play. So which transactions are auditors investigating as potentially fraudulent? Well, it's a needle in a haystack, but all of a sudden the haystack gets a lot smaller. You're playing the numbers game better. Same thing with targeting, marketing, and any and all of these large scale operations I've been talking about. These things can operate autonomously on that way, but you're not going to have a customer facing chatbot anytime soon. You discuss with Paul, and I would love to get a back door conversation with Paul, because I know a lot of the consultancies, both large and small, are really leading with Gen AI and all the excitement to get their foot in the door, but they'll admit behind closed doors, it's still really predictive. Predictive is where most of the money is these days. It's where the established use case and track record of proven returns are. I think that this by 2025 airline chatbots are going to be just as satisfactory as a human customer agent. I think that's very false. I think it's more like 10 years for airlines, maybe 6 for other very finely honed airline tickets is a very complex area, and it requires all sorts of rules and overrides for authorization of can I change the seat and can I change the reservation. But for other more contained, like how do I fix this washing machine, I think that it'll be several years. It's not product development. It's still a research project to get these chatbots to be dependable, reliable, and have the right answer as often as a human expert would.
Eric, you're definitely right, right? There's a training component that actually has to be there, right? And being 85% accurate in customer experience, it's okay. We can get stuff around there. But 85% accuracy in supply chain means manufacturing operations fall, right? 85% accuracy in finance means someone goes to jail. 85% accuracy in healthcare, that's not acceptable, right? And so we see those things in the training models actually popping. And so it's interesting, right? I think the first questions that we should be asking is really, is it something that we're going to solve in a generative model, or is it something that has to be deterministic? And I think that's what you're trying to say here. And I think when we talk to like 25 to 30 services companies, right, they all agree, right? There's a lot of stuff that's going on the deterministic side first, the ML side, and and getting those predictive models right, as opposed to jumping to the generatives. But the problem is the boards are all talking about generative AI, and that's been the challenge. Are you seeing that as well?
Go ahead. Oh, yeah. I mean, that's what everybody's talking about. I'm sorry, Vala, what were you saying?
I don't know if I can name the customer, but there's a large airport in Europe that's using using AI technologies, a client of my company, and they're at a point of closing 4,000 cases a day with chatbots. And the complexity of the cases are continuing to grow because the client is more comfortable letting chatbots continue with the engagement before intervening in the conversation. But it's mind-numbingly cool and fast, up to 4,000 cases closed. And according to the CSAT, they don't have net promoter score yet because they're not the frequency of getting NPS is I believe biannual, whereas the CSAT is transactional. The numbers do not indicate that there's any sort of dissatisfaction with the chatbot closing the case, servicing and closing the case. We'll put that aside. That's a side conversation. our prior guest about 10 years ago started to think about and write a book about AI. When did you realize the importance of ML in business? Like, what was the aha moment for you? And you are certainly now a champion of the cause. So what was the inflection point?
Oh, I'm a huge proponent of the technology. I am married to it. And I've been in the field of machine learning for about 32 years. I was a professor at Columbia in a previous life, teaching the graduate courses in AI and machine learning. It's always been clear to me that this idea of the technology of learning from data to predict and the ability for computers to demonstrably, provably do that better than humans in general, and to discern things from some limited number of historical cases, even if it's a lot, it's still relatively limited compared to the number of situations that you may encounter in the future, and that then it applies and holds up over unseen cases across those many possibilities. That's the best, most interesting kind of technology and science that, as far as I'm concerned, I think it's great. The problem is now we're fetishizing that, and it's like being more in love with the rocket science than the actual launch of the rocket. Getting it launched takes a real pragmatic business practice where you need to reverse plan for that deployment from the get-go. That's what I cover in the AI playbook. And the same concept applies for generative AI. Now, the case study you just described, where you've got a bunch of chatbots serving as a sales funnel, that sounds fascinating. And I'd love it if things like that became more public. But right now, I think that we're hearing a lot of overstatements or sort of unmitigated expectations, and it's poor expectation management. That is to say, hype. And so I'm protective of this field. I've been in it a long time, and there will be disillusionment. We are in a hype cycle, and it's really important to have a concrete value proposition that's credible in terms of what you're going to do now and deploy in somehow the near or medium term, not wait for new unforeseen research breakthroughs that may or may not come true. So again, the ability to create human-like content means it's really great at first drafts of writing, of code, but there very much must be a human in the loop iterating. You got to review and proofread everything that it generates, basically. Now, there are exceptions, entertainment. There's always exceptions in edge cases, but for the most part, right, as seemingly human-like as it is, we need to keep two thoughts in our head at the same time. One is that this is unprecedented. It's amazing. It can deal with all the wide range of human language. It does have emergent capabilities. It can pass some multiple choice tests that it wasn't explicitly programmed to do. That it's so seemingly human-like. And at the same time, keep in our head, that doesn't represent a step towards general human level capabilities. Sure. What people are calling AGI, artificial general intelligence, this really is basically a religious debate. And it's split between the believers and the non-believers. I'm a non-believer in the sense, not that I think it's technically or theoretically impossible, but I do not think that we're actively on a path towards computers that you can onboard like a human employee and let them rip.
Yeah, no, you're putting a really good reality check to this. And I think one of the interesting things is in your chapter, one of the chapters that you have here, I think in the beginning, you talk about this delivery paradox that UPS was facing and really about the challenge when people were actually trying to actually disrupt the warning, disrupt at your own peril. You've seen many projects like this and you see many projects pick up. What advice do you have for people just engaging this? Because it sounds like a dangerous mission, right? I mean, I think it was Jack Levy or Light Levi's looking at
Jack Levis.
Levis was looking at this, right? And you know, he's trying to solve this big problem inside the organization of delivery paradox, trying to find the packages, finding the time, putting it all together, and having incomplete information.
Yeah, that's an amazing.
Is that a common problem? Can you actually categorize this as a common use case like that? I'm sorry, I cut you off there.
Yeah, no. I mean, even if you are focused very clearly on a concrete predictive use case, in the case of UPS, where will we have deliveries tomorrow so we can optimize the planning of how those will be shipped in the trucks? At a shipping center, how do I allocate these 1,000 packages to my 50 trucks for tomorrow morning's deliveries? And at the time that I need to start to plan that and actually start loading the trucks overnight so that it'll... they'll be ready for on-time departures in the morning. I have incomplete information because I don't know. Some of the other packages are incoming. They're not in hand yet. They may not be in the system yet, different time zones. There's all sorts of sources of incompleteness to that information. But the next best thing is to predict. So they augment the known packages with the tentatively assumed packages that are now predicted. And now they have a more complete picture. By doing that in combination with prescribing driving routes, UPS now actively saves 185 million miles of driving a year, $350 million, 8 million gallons of fuel, and 185,000 metric tons of emissions. But as you mentioned, Jack started out and people were warning him, this is career suicide. You're trying to get an established company set in its ways. That company, UPS, is now more than 100 years old, to change their operations. And that's a big missing piece a lot of the time when you conceive of quote unquote AI or machine learning projects, is like, look, this is the best technology. We're going to be, you know, it's the most important general purpose technology. It's the most advanced number crunching, which means it's intrinsically valuable. Let's get a great expert and do it. It's not intrinsically valuable. The value only comes when you actually deploy it. When you actually change your operations, the enterprise practices, it's not business as usual. And so it requires change management. It's not just technology. It's not a technology install. It's like a consulting gig. It's a change to what the company's going to do. That needs to be part of the plan and the practice. Maybe we should reframe these projects and instead of calling them machine learning projects, and Jack Levis did this, he just could process optimization. Sounds boring, but listen, the least sexy projects are actually the sexiest. This is where you enact real change. So we could reframe these projects to not focus so much on the technology, but on their benefit. Operations improvement projects that necessarily use machine learning as a core technology.
And that's great because no one's going to complain that, hey, this is not an AI project. This is process optimization, right? Totally. We're doing cost reduction. We're doing revenue and growth, right? We're doing regulatory compliance, right? So putting it in that way actually gets a lot of buy-in.
Yeah, absolutely. So look, I'll just take the moment to tell listeners what I cover in the book. And we also cover in the conference, Machine Learning Week, was the first week of June in Phoenix, alongside our new sister conference, Generative AI Applications.
Where are you hosting it? In Phoenix. So
yeah, it's in Phoenix, first week of June, Tuesday to Friday. The first 2 days are training workshops, and the main two conference days with about five tracks is Thursday, Friday. So it's those two conferences co-located, Machine Learning Week and Generative AI Application Summit. So it's that head-to-head, right? Predictive, right? Which is older, but not old school. It's where still most of the returns and most of the investment are, but not right.
where most of the attention downtown is. Yep. So
versus generative, right? And there's a shared keynotes at the opening. And in the conference has a business operationalization track, which I call BizML. And that's the practice paradigm framework, the titular playbook of my new AI book, the AI playbook, which is that six step end-to-end practice that engenders deep collaboration between data scientists and stakeholders. And that collaboration is absolutely critical end-to-end across the project if you're hoping to actually get the project deployed.
And why is that? Why does ML need a specialized business process?
Because it's about improving operations with probabilities. And I hate to say the word probability. I know it sounds really boring, but listen, probabilities are the only thing we have, right? One of the last remaining differentiators for large-scale processes across enterprises where so much has been commoditized is prediction. That's the holy grail. But we don't have magic crystal balls. We don't have clairvoyance. We can't expect computers to. Whether a person, individual client, corporate client, or whatever is going to click buy, lie, or die, commit an act of fraud, these outcomes are really hard to predict, but we can put odds on them. And that is to say, predict better than guessing. That turns out to be a huge benefit. You know, if you can predict three times better than guessing, you could improve an untargeted direct mail campaign's profit by a factor of five, for example. So that just takes back the napkin arithmetic. So if you're predicting better than guessing, but not with absolute terms and 100% confidence for each prediction, What is that? It's probabilities. It's a number between 0 and 100. What are the chances that this customer is going to click buy, lie, or die, that this train wheel is going to fail, whatever the outcome or behavior that would serve that particular operation? So that's what it is. But, you know, earlier, Ray, you referred to this idea of deterministic, but I think what you're trying to describe is what I'm referring to actually is predictive and probable.
It is.
You know, so like Nate Silver, in his book, The Signal and the Noise, he talks about we got to do probabilistic thinking. It's more than probabilistic thinking. It's probabilistic doing. It's systematically acting on per case probabilities over millions of decisions. Who to investigate, incarcerate, set up on a date, or medicate. And includes healthcare applications. And the only way you're going to drive those decisions in a more informed, data-driven manner is with probabilities. But that's like a, you know, for the stakeholder, they need to ramp up on some semi-technical understanding of what that involves so they can help guide the project. It's not just a number crunching project.
Plus, you're doing dynamic feedback loops at scale, right? I mean, you're continuing to create these processes. Yeah. And so you're basically trying to do signal intelligence at scale, bring it back, test it again, bring it back, test it again. And this is not at human scale. This is in milliseconds, right? I mean, you're trying to ingest and you're basically refining every time you bring back information insight into the model.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of these deployments are very much real time. For example, fraud detection. I cover FICO, who's so well known for the credit score, but they're probably the biggest part of their software business is in fraud detection. For 2/3 of the world's credit cards, 90% in the US and the UK, every single transaction is screened by FICO's fraud detection model called Falcon in real time to decide whether to authorize that transaction. So yeah, it's got to operate really fast. The good news is that the rocket science part, the learning from data part, where you've got, you know, millions of historical examples from which to learn, that generally takes place offline. Whereas what you've learned, the predictive model, it can, that's exactly what computers are good at doing fast. It can be executed. You can score a case, that is to say, assign a probability. How likely is this case fraud, for example, in very much in real time without disrupting the flow of these transactions.
And you've got Scott Soldi speaking at your conference as well. So that's actually perfect. So
yes, there's a few connections. And so is Jack Levis, who we mentioned from UPS, previously at UPS, and Morgan Vauter, Global VP Analytics at Unilever, who provided a forward to my book. So I've lined up some keynotes at the conference, at the Machine Learning Week side of the conference, that sort of align with the new book.
I recently saw a graph that showed that the number of employees S&P 500 companies needed to produce $1 million in revenue. And I think in 1990, the number was 9. And last year, the number was 2. So 2 employees in every S&P 500 generates $1 million in revenue. And this is, you know, before adoption of some of the all this cool technology we've been talking about the last hour. Do you think the drive for hyper automation, autonomous enterprise, productivity is why people are maybe more excited about the potential of prescriptive use of analytics versus predictive, so that the sales, service, marketing, commerce, whichever line of business you're in, there's a cognitive download from the human to the smart software around them, and that software is guiding them to do what they need to do in real time to deliver value at the speed of need? Why do you think there's so much interest prescriptive, but you know, the generative part versus the predictive part?
Well, I think the interest in generative is because it's more intuitive to your average non-technical person. It literally operates in human natural language.
Yeah, true.
And it's seemingly human-like. And I think because of that, we have a problem, which is that people ascribe too much intelligence. And intelligence is a very subjective word. It's a problem when we try to ascribe that word to machines. But one way or another, we're trying to improve efficiencies. I think that the ability to write, to draft first passes on writing like a paragraph that a customer service agent might modify and then copy paste into a chat with you know, an end customer, that can really improve efficiencies. But it's not going to improve it by a factor of 100. You're not going to cut 99 out of 100 employees. It could improve efficiencies by 20%, or 90, it could almost double efficiencies. It depends, right? It's the wild, wild west now of this stuff. And it ultimately just depends on which language model you're using and who's using it for exactly what business context and application. You just need to try it out and see how much it improves efficiencies. But get your head out of the clouds. Don't fall for how intoxicating the human-like side of it is. Keep focus on the value. This is exactly how these customer service agents are going to work with automatically generated copy. But they need to be instructed not to trust it too much, because if they blindly copy paste, there's going to be some problems. And then have a rigorous way of measuring just how much more efficient. I think that with that in mind, it's easy to see that the fears of, you know, computers taking over and huge corporate downsizing because so many processes can be automated is overblown. And that for most of the applications of generative, it's not about autonomy. Whereas for the predictive side, where it's large scale operations being improved by a single model, that's where there's leniency. It's already a numbers game. Most mail is junk mail. Many fraudulent transactions go through. It's about improving those numbers, and this is the way to do it. And you're adding something automatic. It's very sophisticated the way it's learned from data, but it's not that time consuming per transaction. As you said, the speed of need, and need is very speedy. So it happens. I also would like to clarify that prescriptive and predictive are kind of a distinction without a difference. For the most part, it's usually really quite straightforward to convert from a prediction, a probability, this customer is much more likely than average to buy, to an action. Well, okay, well then let's spend $2 sending them a brochure. Sometimes there's a couple if-then statements, a business rule, but it's not a whole new realm of technology.
No, this is the next best action capability. You have six steps that to machine learning development. This is your BizML. Quickly, what are those six steps?
Well, the bigger theme is that the business stakeholders need to ramp up. And so let me just tell you what you need to know about a predictive project. And it corresponds with the first three steps of six.
So the value of the target performance.
To get the actual thing deployed. So it actually makes not only generate potential value, but capture that value because you've improved and thereby necessarily changed operations. So for any predictive use case, it's what's predicted and what's done about it, right? Who's going to click buy, lie, or die in order to decide, contact them, treat them, investigate, incarcerate, all these different things, right? Depending on, you know, whether to administer a certain healthcare, whether to reevaluate a patient before discharging them because they have a high risk of being readmitted, right? That's why this technology is considered the most important general purpose technology of the century, because that pair that defines a use case, there's an endless realm of possibilities, what's predicted and what's done about it. The other question, of course, is how well is it predicted? How good is the model? How much better than guessing does it predict? And in some cases, it can be very confident. Is there a traffic light in this picture? What's the medical diagnosis from this radiology image? And in that case, it's not about a magic crystal ball. Both humans and computers often can do even better than humans, can have very high confidence for both positive and negative cases in those particular use cases. But either way, it's about automating that prediction and putting those probabilities. But defining the metrics, which really is just arithmetic, but it's very particular arithmetic, is something that's generally overlooked with these projects in a way that translates to the business stakeholders. For example, the line of business manager in charge of running the operation is meant to be improved by the model. So what you need to do is have some kind of concrete sense of how much better it is than guessing, some metric that's about the technical pure predictive performance, and then also the business metric. What's the KPI? It's like profit or ROI. If we deploy this model in this way, if we integrate it, operationalize it into existing operations in this particular way, how much does it stand to improve those bottom line measures like ROI and profit? So what's predicted, how well, what's done about it? Not in that order corresponds to the first three steps or really pre-production. Define the project, make sure everyone's on the same page, and we've really pathed a concrete, credible route to successful deployment. The other three steps in the BizML practice I set forth in the book are the same steps that have always existed since the 1960s when we started using regression to target marketing and prep, train,
and deploy. So
yeah, exactly. Prep the data, train the model from that data, and then implement the model.
Well, we're here with Eric Siegel, author of the AI Playbook, Monetizing the Rare Art of Machine Learning Development. So thanks so much for being here. Great X handle, Predict Analytic. And thanks for being on the show. Happy Friday.
Congratulations on the book, Eric. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Get the book, come to the conference. So
great.
Are you AI'd out? I'm not.
No. In fact,
I want more.
I mean, I've got these are two of the biggest minds in the space. It's nice to have that balanced discussion because look, in the last 30 days, just for the last 30 days, I've got Sam Altman saying one person can build a unicorn now. I've got, Jensen, CEO of NVIDIA, say by 2029, all human tests will be passed by AI. I've got Ray Kurzweil, who 20 years ago said by 2029, we'll have AGI, and Elon Musk saying that's too conservative before that. So you've got like titans of the industry giving us all this futuristic points of view in terms of how fast this is advancing. So it's great to have a 30-year ML practitioner, professor, thought leader, kind of bring some balanced discussion. Because if you're like me and you're reading the news and reading conference updates and all, you've got folks telling us things are moving much faster than we ever imagined. Your thoughts?
We definitely get a pragmatic view of where we are today. And like we say all the time, most people don't have enough data to get to a level of precision that their stakeholders will trust. And I think that's going to be a very important piece. And if you're spending billions of dollars on this project and realize that you're not going to get to that level of precision, then when and where you insert a human is going to be very, very important in the process. And so we're going to see all that kind of fun stuff. So, but yeah, definitely some great conversations here.
Amazing. I'll be watching it again this weekend because both guests dropped some wisdom nuggets that I need to reflect on. Next week, episode 360. And our first guest is the first podcast guest I had when I launched my podcast in 2013. And he was my first guest, Guy Kawasaki, chief evangelist at Canva, former chief evangelist at Apple. In fact, when Alex Dion offered me the evangelist role at Salesforce, the only other guy I could think of that had evangelist in his title, the only guy I could think of was Guy Kawasaki. He's former trustee at Wikipedia, author of 16 books, including Think Remarkable, 9 Paths to Transform Your Life and Make a Difference. So extraordinary guest. By the way, he hired Mark Benioff as an intern at Apple. So Mark's first boss was Guy Kawasaki.
There you go.
Who's the founder of my company. And Michael Southworth, CEO of Babel Street, will be our guest. So Guy and Michael, episode 360. If it's Friday, it's Disrupt TV. We look forward to seeing you next week. Bye, everyone.
Hey, thanks, everybody.